most of the work that I do ends up, I think, being a lot more influenced by my philosophy pedigree than my computer science pedigree. And I think that is, you know, there are lots of people who understand how to make really good algorithms and build things really well. And there are not as many people who can sort of take that step back and say, well, why are we building this? And what is this for? And is this the right approach? And is this the right metaphor and the right mental model and all that stuff?
That is Ian Varley, a principal architect here at Salesforce. I'm Josh Burke, a developer evangelist with Salesforce. And here on the Salesforce Developer Podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we sit down and talk with Ian about Salesforce's multi-tenant architecture, something he has been working on for the last 10 years and comprises the core of what Salesforce actually is. And to kick things off, we ask the question, well, what is multi-tenancy?
Ah, really good question. I have an article out there that I published called Leet Multi-Tenancy, and I've been trying for years to get everyone to use a what's the word for when you have an abbreviation that puts the number of letters in the middle and a numeric?
Oh, I don't know.
There's a word for that.
Like LE for ET or something like
well,
that.
Well, no, but more like internationalization, right? Where you put... And so I've been trying to get people to use M10Y. For multi-tenancy, because it's 10 letters in the middle. And literally no one does. It's just me. I'm going to keep working on that. So the basic idea of multi-tenancy is all software that you use is multi-user software, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning, if you think about something like Gmail, they're not running a copy of Gmail for every single person that has a Gmail account. Right? They're running one big instance and it has all these different users in it. Multi-tenancy is like one step beyond that. Instead of just individual users who use the system as if it's isolated, you have groups of users who use the system mm-hmm. as if it's isolated. Right. And so this could be, for example, everyone in a company. And so, you know, if your company buys Salesforce, then you are a tenant and you have a bunch of users and a bunch of configuration and a bunch of data that all of those users share. And the fact that it's a multi-tenant system means we have these tenants and we have lots of those tenants being run on the same hardware and software concurrently. So that's the core idea of what multi-tenancy is.
So side note, I think it's kind of funny that the most common phrase for that tenant is, you know, people talk about it in terms of a Salesforce org. Mm-hmm. Which sounds, it's very jargony and it confuses people like when they first hear it, but it's actually a very on the nose name mm-hmm. for what you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Organization. And it's funny because, you know, across the different parts of Salesforce that have come in through acquisition, there are different names for that thing.
Right.
Right. And so you might call it, some parts of Salesforce call it a member or an enterprise or a site. Or a realm, or like there's all these different words for the same concept, which we're, you know, we've worked towards, you know, kind of aligning those over the years. But yeah, that is the core, the CRM core kind of terminology for that is an org or an organization.
Right. And of course, realm, I will just have to give a shout out to the World of Warcraft players out there.
Yes.
Okay. So architecturally speaking, how are we actually defining that tenant? Like what kind of hardware, what kind of virtual machines are we talking about?
Well, so... The tenant itself isn't, you know, because this is all sort of software-based multi-tenancy, the tenant mm-hmm. isn't actually represented in any actual instantiation of hardware, either, you know, physically or virtually. So there's not, for example, a set of, you know, Docker containers somewhere that is your org.
Got it.
The way that it actually works in the CRM products is there's a table called organization. And there's a row in that table for your organization, and it has an ID. And then every other table in the system has a column called organization ID that has that value in it if it's your row. And every single query in the system adds where organization ID equals X. At some level, it's as simple as that, right? That mm-hmm. that you have all these tables and so forth in the system. And there's other things we can get into about the kind of the metadatabase-ness of Salesforce, which is mm-hmm. interesting to talk about. We can talk about that in a minute. But just from the multi-tenancy perspective, it's really kind of as simple as that. And that means, you know, if there's a container somewhere running an application server, for example.
Yeah.
Each individual request that comes into that application server is going to have some context, right? It's going to have some authentication of who's the request coming from and is it authenticated? And then as part of that, they're going to say, okay, the organization ID is X. And that gets carried along with that request as it travels through the call stack of the application server. And so you could say, you know, each function it enters, there's a context object that goes along with it. And that context object, you could say, who's the user and who's the organization? And those get automatically bound to any kind of database queries that are going on. And so it's you know, pretty much impossible for that request to access anything other than the resources to which it is authenticated and authorized.
Got it. And if we're flipping that around, how do we go about grouping those kinds of services? And like when we think about it as a group of things that the user can use on the system, what does that start to look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, there are a pretty large number of individual software services that make up Salesforce. Mm-hmm. For a lot of what most people interact with, which is to say Sales Cloud, Service Cloud, Communities, the Salesforce platform, there is really one pair of dominant services.
Okay.
That is the Salesforce application server and the database. And if you really had to break it down to like what happens to this to a user request, yes, there are lots of other systems and services that it passes through, like load balancers and caches and so forth. But right. The heart of it is really these two. Mm-hmm. And you know, the request comes in, it lands on an application server. The application server says, "Okay, I've got you. I know your context. I know what database to connect you to, and I'm going to connect to the database, run queries that are as defined by the code path for whatever your request is, and return those results to you." Now, that's In very broad strokes, that's, you know, most of what happens for these core requests. But then, you know, when you think about how that can spiral out into lots and lots of other services, I'll just take one example. Think about the way that search works.
Yeah.
So when you log into Salesforce and you say, "I want to search for banana," there's a couple of ways you could implement that, because presumably you want to find banana in whatever database tables it is. So you could theoretically say, "Oh, okay, user wants to know about banana," and then iterate through every single table in the system and say, you know, run a SQL statement that says, you know, select all the records where name contains banana or address contains banana or this field contains banana, right, so forth, and then right. Do that for every single. Now, I'm being facetious because obviously that would never work.
Right.
That would be completely impractical. So the way that search works is there's a background process that every time data is changed in any way, it indexes that data, meaning it takes all of the values from the record that was changed, mm-hmm. and it creates a reverse index of that where it says, okay, you know, if the answer to your name is, you know, John Banana, then I'm going to take this last name field that says banana, and I'm going to put an entry under banana in this index that says, if someone looks for banana, there's a record here that has banana in it. Now, that service, that indexing service, is a separate service, right? That's not the application server and it's not the database. It's a whole separate service running on hardware somewhere that gets this stream of data and does this. And then, you know, just picture that, you know, also when you actually do the search query for banana, again, it's going to spawn that out to another service that knows how to look at those search indexes and return the results with the pointers to the records that you want to be looking for. So that's just one example among hundreds of, you know, sort of specialized services that are part of this overall, you know, suite of things that power the software that you use. And of course, because it's software as a service, and I guess this is something I should have said before, fundamentally, you don't care. Like, as the person using the software, you don't know nor care how many services it's broken up into and how that stuff is all partitioned. And those are engineering problems and optimization problems for our team. But from the outside, it should look very much like, well, I just do stuff and it just works. It's magic.
Yeah, because going back from multi-tenancy before we're multi-tenant, we are a multi-tenant platform as a service. And so the user is really only supposed to be concerned with login.salesforce.com and we handle the rest.
Yeah. And then, you know, all of the, like, that's, you know, all of the things that we have to deal with, you know, like getting on the phone with a database vendor or, you know, applying, you know, just last week, one of our subsystems had one of our networking subsystems, and I won't mention which one, had a P0, you know, 0-day security vulnerability that, you know, was just came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And it affected hundreds of physical, you know, software appliances in our data centers. And, you know, there are a whole lot of Salesforce customers who have no reason to know about that and never will know about that because we just handled it, right? We just said, okay, we've got it. We've got our team. We're going to go out there. We're going to patch these things. You know, we're going to test them. We're going to make sure everything works. And then up, you know, it goes back up and running. And there's no downtime. There's no interruption for people, but there's a whole lot of burden there. And this is the whole, you know, the whole point of software as a service, isn't it? Right? Like that, you're essentially as a service, I'm selling you not worrying about all of that crap.
Right. You're the consumer and how we built it, boxed it, got it to you. You don't care.
Exactly.
It's like an Amazon box. All you really care about is that it showed up at your door.
Yep. So that, you know, that's the power of running a software as a service.
Right.
Now, the power of running a multi-tenant service is a little bit, you know, different than that in the sense that Again, you know, customers don't care whether the hardware that's running them has just them or them and 10,000 other customers. However, they don't care until they do.
Right? Right. You don't care about your neighbors until they get really loud and rowdy.
Exactly. And we do, you know, from time to time have issues where, you know, because Salesforce is a platform that's so open-ended, you can do so much with it. You know, you can write code, of course, as people listening to this podcast know, that runs on, you know, on Salesforce servers and does pretty non-trivial things. But think about that from a resource perspective. That is really physically a CPU somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that CPU is shared by hundreds or maybe thousands of tenants at the same time. And so if that runs away with a bunch of resources, you know, well, do all of your neighbors suddenly, are things running sluggish for them, right? So a big part of our responsibility as the service provider in a multi-tenant service is to make sure that that doesn't happen and that, you know, everything is, you know, usage is kept within resource limits and that we're monitoring to say, oh gosh, you know, this one customer is heating up here. Mm-hmm. Like let's, you know, there's lots of examples I could cite, but like, let's say you provide, you know, services to people who want to file their taxes, for example, or, right. You know, services to people who want to go shopping on Black Friday, right? There's a big spike in usage from one tenant on those days. And it's our job to make sure that that doesn't reflect on the usage of everybody else who's using the system at the same time.
Right.
And we have to play lots of tricks to do that.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the structure of all of that. And first, I saw this term in one of your presentations, and it kind of just tickles me a little bit. I think Stephen Tam coined the term meso-services. What exactly do we mean by that?
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Tam did coin that phrase. You know, the hot term in the industry these days is microservices.
Right.
And actually, that's the hot term from a few years ago. The hot term now is serverless or, you know, whatever's after that. But microservices, of course, being a pretty trendy thing to do where you say, you know, I mean, like I mentioned before, Salesforce does run plenty of what you would properly describe as microservices, like an indexing service. Mm-hmm. For search indexing, right? That is exactly a microservice. And the trend is, okay, well, rather than having, you know, big monolithic pieces of software, we're going to have these smaller, purpose-built, independent, individual services, and they all interact. And that's all well and good. And it carries its own burdens in terms of managing that, you know, huge number of services and letting them interact and debugging problems and other things like that. But it's a perfectly viable architectural pattern. However, when you think about what Salesforce is and does, you know, I mentioned that core application server. One of the really cool things about the kind of core suite of products from Salesforce, including sales and service and so forth, is because of the platform nature of Salesforce, you really, we open it up for customers to do pretty interesting and novel things. Mm-hmm. On the platform as far as kind of piecing together and combining functionality. So you could do things like, you know, save an object and run some validations on it and then post to a chatter feed and, you know, all these other things kind of all in one piece of code, one piece of Apex code. You could do that, for example. And that's really cool. But what that means is that all of those participating pieces that do all of those functions need to be callable code within the same executable. And because of the sort of transactional, the database transactional nature, there's ways you could do that without invoking, you know, a single database transaction, mm-hmm. but they tend to be a bit complex and brittle. And so, you know, the way that this is implemented for Salesforce is a monolithic service. It is a fairly large kind of all-encompassing service that does a lot of this, and which is the application server that I mentioned before. And so when we think about, you know, there are certain microservice patterns that apply very much to Salesforce, but we have to think about it in kind of the more nuanced and complicated world of interactions of microservices and mesoservices or macroservices or whatever you want to call them. There's different challenges associated with both, but it's always going to be a mix for us just because of the nature of the application that we run.
I feel like somehow we've created like monolithic plus plus or something.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot because, you know, everybody likes to kind of rag on monoliths and they have their problems. Mm-hmm. You know, for sure, building the Salesforce application is not trivial and working in it is an acquired taste. but like, you know, that said, the things that it lets our customers do is really impressive.
Right.
And the things that it lets us, like it's sort of this multiplicative value because of all the things. I mean, I haven't even mentioned, you know, beyond the platform, there's also the entire ecosystem, right, of mm-hmm. ISVs and so forth. And so to be able to kind of support and engender all of that, that's really where, I guess, the kind of cohesive nature of the platform really matters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for us, the fact that this is a monolith actually has a lot of advantages that would be extremely difficult to replicate if we tried to break it up into a huge number of smaller services. And, you know, we're already seeing some of the challenges as we try to, you know, integrate and include parts of Salesforce that came in by acquisition and things like that, right?
Right.
We see exactly how challenging it is when you don't get to do it in a monolith.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're making progress in all those ways as well. But it really does make us appreciate the elegance of the monolith that we do have. You know, for all its warts, it is extremely powerful and extremely useful to our customers.
Right. Well, so let's talk about that for a second, because, you know, as we've joked, like this is a company that does a lot of acquisitions. It does a lot of acquisitions across industry and technology. So how has that looked in the past sometimes? Because I would imagine a product like Heroku is much different than, say, you know, Community Cloud or Commerce Cloud when it comes to trying to have that integrated back into the platform.
Yeah, I mean, it's all over the map. And there's lots of different, I'm not an expert on acquisition, so I won't speak to the strategy of it too much, but you know, there are certain acquisitions that we do that just are tuck-ins, right? That just become part of the product and get integrated very, very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, a recent example of that is actually Salesforce Maps. Mm-hmm. That was an acquisition called Map Anything, and I don't think I'm giving any way that's not publicly known by saying that. And that is, you know, Map Anything was an incredible company that does really innovative stuff. I mean, I think most people think like, oh, you've got Google Maps and Google Maps is all you need to know, right? Everybody could just use Google Maps or, you know, or another similar service. But it turns out that in the enterprise world, when you're trying to run a business, there's all kinds of things that are not supported by sort of a consumer level map program like that.
Right.
And just an example of this is if you're trying to ship things, you need to know clearance, mm-hmm. right? How tall are your trucks and how tall are those bridges that you're trying to go under? And you know, that's not in Google Maps, right? You need something that's a little bit more heavy duty to be able to give you routing and optimization with those kinds of constraints. So anyway, that's a bit of a tangent. Map Anything is a super cool company that now is completely integrated into Salesforce as Salesforce Maps. Right. And it's not standalone in any way. It's just its own Salesforce now.
And I have to just say, I'm actually quite glad for that evolution, because back in the day when everybody was doing demos around Google Maps, I always had to put in the asterisk, read their license. It's not as open as you might think.
Yes. This is, read the fine print for sure. So that's one example. But then there are absolutely, like Heroku is a very, very different beast, right? Where, you know, Heroku is a completely independent sort of way of thinking about your development lifecycle. And there's plenty of people who use Heroku who don't use anything else from Salesforce. Now that said, Heroku is also a big part of the actual Salesforce strategy. And there's stuff that we just announced at Trailhead DX about that integration that's really interesting and cool. And so it is very integral. But like for many years, it was completely standalone and it was not integrated with Salesforce, with the rest of Salesforce at all. Yeah. So you have some that are like that. And then there's some that are kind of in between where it's like, yeah, this is on the road to being fully integrated, but it's not fully integrated yet. And, you know, I'm sure anyone who's in the technology world can appreciate the complexity of taking two completely different architectures and merging them into one unified thing.
Right.
It's not child's play.
You can't just shove the two things together. Right.
No, you get bad results if you do that. So, you know, there really is a pretty wide spectrum of how these things work. But the cool part about it is, I guess, that, you know, every acquisition is an infusion, not just of new like business capabilities and code and things like that, but also new patterns and new ways of thinking about things, right? When you're in, you know, a company and Salesforce is a fantastic company to work for, which means that lots of people stay at Salesforce for a very long time, which means they haven't worked at other companies for a very long time.
Right.
Right. And so you tend very naturally towards being a little insular and saying things like, well, that's just how we've always done things.
Right.
And so it is really important to kind of get that infusion of new ideas, both from new hires, but also really collectively from, you know, joining with an entirely different software development culture or different approach to things. And so that's been hugely influential. And I mean, it's, you know, I think about it a little bit like, you know, it's sort of the melting pot idea of we get the best of what everybody's thinking across all these different acquisitions. And that's important.
Nice. Okay. So let's go back to core itself, like what you and I think of as the application slash platform. How would you actually define Salesforce core itself?
So fundamentally, Salesforce Core is sort of a database with forms on top. I'm being a bit facetious, but not very.
Right.
Like when I first came to Salesforce, I saw that and I was like, wait, isn't this just, you know, database backed forms? And they said, yeah, database backed forms, multi-tenant as a service. Like that's what people need.
Yeah.
Now, what's facetious about that is, of course, there's actually tons and tons more, you know, sort of functionality and value that's layered on top of that.
Right.
So I'm being facetious. There's an immense amount of actual, you know, business value and product there. Mm-hmm. But architecturally, when you really get, you know, deep down to the bottom of it, what is Salesforce? Well, it's a way, you know, the Salesforce platform is a way for people to define important business concepts and set that up to collect and view data about those important business concepts. And those concepts could be the ones that are built in as part of a particular product, like accounts and contacts are part of Sales Cloud. Right? They could be on the other end of the spectrum, things that are completely special to your business, right? Like, you know, if you sell golf clubs, then you could have a golf club object in Salesforce, right? And what the Salesforce software does is it sets up all of the things that you need to semantically define and use this set of things via metadata. Mm-hmm. Now, metadata is it's a big word that has lots of different meanings for lots of different people. So I'll tell you what I mean by metadata. For me, metadata is data that can alter the behavior of your software. Now, that's not everybody's definition of metadata, but that's my definition of metadata.
Okay.
Right. So, for example, a configuration setting that tells you, you know, whether to display your charts in high contrast or not in high contrast for people with visual impairment.
Right.
Right. That's a piece of metadata. That's a configuration. Similarly, if you sell golf clubs and, you know, the things that you want to store about a golf club are, you know, its make and model and color and size and I don't play golf. I don't know what else you define about a golf club, but those are like, that's the schema of your golf club object. And that's metadata in the system.
Right. Right?
But then beyond that, each of those pieces of information about that golf club, you know, like, you know, the fact that the length is a number, right? That's metadata as well. And the fact that, you know, that someone, that a field in an object might be a URL or it might be a date, right? That those are pieces of metadata. Those contribute to the metadata of that the system is doing. And then the software, what it does is it uses all of this metadata about your business, about your semantics, to drive all kinds of fancy, cool stuff, like you know, generating reports in Tableau, and you know, allowing you to quickly mock up UI forms or automatically generate mobile views, and so like because of the richness of the metadata, that's what really gives the CRM core application its power to do all this amazing stuff. And then what you layer on top of that is then, yes, you know, Salesforce engineers can define some of this metadata for the products that we ship, like Sales Cloud and Service Cloud.
Right.
You as an end customer can define this for your own company, for your own org or tenant, right?
Right.
But then ISVs can also come in and say, hey, we're going to offer a package that other customers could buy on top of Salesforce. And, you know, we're going to define that metadata in a way that can be installed. So there is really this wide set of ways that the metadata can be used and can come about. But that's, if I had to really describe what is this application, that's what it is. It's something that facilitates the creation and use of semantic and structural metadata to empower a customer to store data about the concepts that are important to them.
See, that's interesting because when I've had people in the past ask me, like, defining standard objects and custom objects and metadata, I typically stick to a very, like, structural point of view. In fact, I think the analogy I use, usually the use was like a blueprint. Like, you know, if the standard objects is your four-room house, but you wanted to add a swimming pool, well, the first thing we do is we actually extend the blueprint. We don't just dig a hole in your backyard and then be done with it. And the reason we have that blueprint is because if somebody else wanted that exact same swimming pool, we just move the blueprint over to that house and wash, rinse, repeat. But you're kind of saying that it's also a layer above that as well. So it's not just the size and the shape of the pool, but also what kind of water they would use, what month it was going to be placed in, the architect that was going to be used, and the data around that data structure in order to kind of make the swimming pool really work.
And I'll give you an example why that's so important. Is if you think about Einstein and, you know, the AI use cases within Salesforce and the things we can do, a lot of what we can do there, we can do because we know more about this data. And let me qualify it in a second, but we know more about this data than just the kind of basic types you would see in a programming language like Java. Like we know, we don't just know that this is a number. We know that this is a phone number, right? And from an AI perspective, that tells us very different things about what we can do, you know, whether this is a useful, you know, thing to cluster data on, which in phone number, it almost never is, right? We have that kind of additional level of semantic understanding. Now, when I say we, just to be clear, what I don't mean there is that Salesforce employees and engineers are like going and looking at these things that customers do and then creating AI on top of that. In, you know, in certain situations in like a proof of concept where we have a special agreement with the customer, we'll do that. But generally speaking, we don't do any of that. This is all automated. We build the machines that can then introspect whatever the customer's metadata is at runtime and do the appropriate thing, precisely so that, you know, people from Salesforce don't have to be sort of in a hands-on way, you know, manipulating this to get good AI outcomes. All of that is, that's just one example of the kind of richness and value you get from having this deeper level of semantic integration around data.
Right. Well, let's talk about how that really kind of works out physically, because I remember back in my workshop days, people would ask me like, well, is all of this running on Oracle? And my response was something like, well, kind of, but not in the way you think. So how does this work from like a physical database layer point of view in order to make what you just said actually happen?
Yeah. So one of the most interesting and maybe improbable things about the Salesforce software is that the how deep the meta-ness goes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a word, meta-ness, but how...
Hold on, I'll allow it.
Okay, how deep the meta-ness goes. So when you create a custom object in Salesforce, under the covers, there is, in fact, a relational database down there that has rows for that. But what it doesn't have is it does not have an actual physical table in the database for that object. Everything is done completely virtually. So under the covers, of course, there is a relational database there that's storing all this stuff. But when you define a custom object, it's not actually instantiating a table at the relational database level. It's not doing a create table statement for real. What it's doing is just adjusting some metadata in a few tables. And then the entire engine of the application server is there to give the illusion that that's a physical table. When in reality, you know, custom object data is actually stored in one big table, one big relational database table called custom entity data. And for every, and it has, I think at last count, 500 fields, 500 varchar fields in it. And when I create an object called golf club and I say that it has a length field, there's a mapping in metadata that says, okay, you know, that's actually column three for this tenant. Column three in the custom entity, when you see one of these objects, custom column three is length. And it does all of that translation in the layers of this application so that, you know, you get back something that looks pretty much just like, you know, a result set might from doing a direct SQL query against a database.
Right.
But it is, you know, indeed much more complicated than that. And the outcome of this, by the way, when I first, you know, started at Salesforce and I saw that arrangement, I was like, no way. There's no way that could ever work. It's impossible. You could never run a big system like that. And I was completely wrong. And, you know, in point of fact, there are a lot of things that we do to make that possible at the optimization level. We have a whole team dedicated full time to ensuring that the optimizer for our product is really working well.
Interesting.
I mean, if you've ever done anything with, you know, database internals, you know that generating the physical plan from a SQL statement is not trivial, especially when you have things like joins and all that stuff, right? You have to figure out which join strategy should I use. And if we were just to leave that up to the database itself to sort of figure that stuff out, nothing would ever function. And so instead, what we do is every single query that actually goes to the physical database is heavily, heavily hinted. We essentially exactly specify the query plan.
Got it.
We exactly specify, okay, start, you know, if you're doing a join, start with this, do a nested loop, you know, join to this other table, lead on this index. All of that stuff is exactly specified by the engine. Otherwise, it would never work. So, you know, you really have this really interesting meta database. But then what that means is we, you know, because the database is under our control, it's got pluses and minuses. The pluses are we can extend it to do all kinds of really neat things that you couldn't do directly in a relational database. The downside is that we pretty much are responsible for all of the things that a relational database would normally do out of the box for you.
Right.
So for an example of this is indexes.
Right.
We can't just use indexes in the database. We have to maintain indexes and hints directly. Another one is foreign keys. We don't have any foreign keys in the database. All of that has to be maintained at the software level because it's so complex in this meta way. So it's super interesting, super different from what I think people envision is happening, but it's what has to happen because specifically it is a multi-tenant environment.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to talk about a couple ancillary topics. And one is one that I think you've admitted you could talk about all day long if you were allowed to. We don't have that kind of time. So if you could give me the elevator pitch for why, just kind of simply why awareness of cognitive bias is important to your field of work.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So for those of you who are not super familiar, when I say cognitive bias, I don't mean prejudice in favor of or against a person or a thing or group, mm-hmm. as people often use the word bias. I just mean a systematic tendency to deviate from an expected value. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of bias that I mean, like the engineering concept of bias, like in an electrical system. A cognitive bias is a systematic pattern of deviation from rationality in your judgments. Basically, it's just bugs in our mental operating system, right? Like a case where if you really sit down and think about something and do a logical analysis, you will come to one conclusion. But your brain, when you know, when push comes to shove, will not come to that conclusion. It will come to a different conclusion, right? And there's a whole bunch of, you know, documented cognitive biases in the psychology literature. But there's, when you think about these in, so I did a presentation about this, about cognitive biases and software architecture. It was called Brains Considered Harmful. and it sort of just evaluated a bunch of different cases where our brains do the wrong thing.
Yeah.
So a simple example of this is the planning fallacy. Mm-hmm. The planning fallacy says that you basically always underestimate how long something's going to take.
Got it.
Doesn't matter where you start. Doesn't matter what your prediction is. Doesn't matter how you do it. Yeah. You're going to underestimate.
Yeah.
And this is famous in, you know, in software circles for, you know, the last, you know, 10% of the project takes 90% of the time.
Right, exactly. Right.
And so, you know, we've learned as an industry to get past this using, you know, agile techniques and things like that. And there are other ways to do it. But my favorite example of this is actually called Hofstadter's Law. If you know Douglas Hofstadter.
Yeah.
He says things always take longer than you expect them to, even when you take into account Hofstadter's Law. So
nice. It's just a,
yeah, so. Nice. So that's just sort of a garden variety example of the kind of cognitive biases that can impact, you know, the creation of software.
Right.
A more nuanced one is one that's near and dear to my heart called the sunk cost fallacy. And the sunk cost fallacy basically says we are sort of wired to throw good money after bad.
Right.
If you've invested anything in some project or some idea, you will be unable to judge whether it's the right thing to do because you've already invested in it.
Right, right.
You will overvalue it.
Yeah.
And this happens all the time to people in who are doing software architecture, because the sheer act of working on a technical system biases you in favor of that system, regardless of the facts of the matter.
Okay, so I wanted to wrap with something relevant to the time that we're recording in. Salesforce was working with various governments to enable them to fight COVID-19. It's a huge push for the company right now. What's some success we've had at that, and kind of specifically, how is it this architecture that we're talking about, how does that make it more successful?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the key things that everyone should be doing, not that necessarily everyone is doing it, but that everyone should be doing during this period of our lives, is something called contact tracing, which is when someone gets sick with a virus, you find out as quickly as you can anyone that they've been in contact with, and you go and you contact those people and you tell them to quarantine. And if they haven't been quarantining, you ask them who they've been in contact with, and you repeat. And the whole idea here is to make people aware they're infected soon enough that they can avoid infecting others, mm-hmm. and thus stop the spread of the pandemic and reduce the R value and all that stuff. So this is like this extremely basic, extremely critical thing that not everyone's getting right now. And one of the really cool things that Salesforce has done is worked with the state of Rhode Island, mm-hmm. To actually provide them the software, because the software that helps them actually do the contact tracing, that backs this contact tracing information. Because
gotcha.
When you really think about it, this is not all that different from the kinds of information you would collect in a CRM system. You know, this
right.
is facts about people and where they were and who they had relationships with.
Mm-hmm.
And it really sort of allows you to build up that picture. And Salesforce was able to do this precisely because we built a general purpose platform mm-hmm. that allows you to collect any kind of data like this once you've defined it semantically. So I think really in a very rapid way, Salesforce was able to produce contact tracing software, a subject that 6 months ago, none of us had ever heard of, right?
Right.
to actually get it in the hands of, in this case, you know, the state of Rhode Island, who's had immense success, keeping COVID under wraps in their state.
Nice.
So that's a just kind of a demonstration of, hey, the architecture of this product really lends itself to rapidly creating extremely valuable things that, you know, if you had to start from scratch and build up all the infrastructure to do this, it would be very, very time consuming and costly. And remember, this is on top of a platform where privacy and security are like paramount concerns. Like, this is enterprise software.
Right.
This isn't something that you just, you know, found on the internet and downloaded. This is very high grade, serious stuff that's compliant and secure and all this stuff. And so, you know, people are worried and should be rightly worried about the privacy of information that's used in contact tracing systems. I don't want that going into some, you know, just some shareware that somebody downloaded and installed on their laptop. I want that going into a system that is, verifiably and auditably secure and private.
And that's our show. Now, I do want to point out that in addition to the software engineering master's degree and the philosophy degree mentioned earlier in this episode, Ian also has a music degree.
I actually play a lot of, these days, traditional Irish music, and I play accordion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's the right response to that. Oh, wow.
I want to thank Ian for the great conversation. Of course, I want to thank you for listening. Now, we will include a link to Ian's presentation on cognitive bias in the show notes. And speaking of those notes, if you want to learn more about this podcast, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, read the show notes, and also have links to your favorite podcast service. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you next week.